Hi everyone, you're listening to the Accents podcast on WKY. This episode is brought to you by Kentucky Humanities and the Kentucky Book Festival. I am the host, Katerina Stoikova, and my guest today is poet Linnell Edwards. Hi Linnell, welcome to Accents.
Thank you, I'm very happy to be here.
This is not our first conversation. We have done a few of those over the years.
Yes, it's been a while, but I'm very excited to be back and talking with you.
The Bearable Slant of Light. Please tell the listeners of Accents about this book.
So this book, I began writing poems about the central subject, which is the onset and struggle of my youngest son with bipolar disorder. And so I've been writing poems about it since, again, the onset of that in 2014. In the meantime, I had a chapbook come out that was an entirely other project, a different project, but I was always working on this. And in tandem with writing poems about my son's struggle, I was also interested in the ways in which mental illness is depicted in American literature. Particularly, there are a surprising number of crazy young men in American literature, from Quentin Compson to Holden Caulfield, and those characters became interesting to me. And so I began writing some poems about that. And then it's just been an anxious time these last 4 or 5 years. There are a few poems that represent my own anxieties, not in any clinical sense. I am lucky enough not to struggle with a diagnosed mental illness, but we're all anxious, and there are some poems in here that get at that. At some point, as we do, we recognize we have something that might be a book, and so I began assembling the poems and putting together them together and see how they would talk to one another. It was a really difficult collection to figure out how to structure. And then we might talk more about that at a later point. But one of the things that I realized, several years ago, just in talking with my son and with clinicians and reading about bipolar disorder and mental illness generally, is that in many ways, a serious and persistent mental illness is also a lack of narrative. There aren't clear stories of onset, struggle, survival, victory over the illness, and then carrying on. And so it was difficult to figure out, well, what's the arc of this book? How does this go together? In the opening poem, there's a brief phrase that says, none of this is in any order.
Maybe that's why it's called Medical History Number 2.
That's exactly right. insofar, there is no Medical History Number 1 in the book.
Or three,
or any more medical histories. There's a lot of medical papers, but we just start with, well, here's number two, because while there is no medical history number one in the book, there were lots and lots and lots of medical histories given and reported over the last 7 years. So that's a little bit about how it came together.
I'd like to hear the poem that I mentioned, mm-hmm. Medical History Number 2.
So this was a poem that came together pretty quickly. It was not heavily revised, and it is a response. Every time my son was in the hospital, a clinician would ask about a kind of medical history, bring us up to speed. And this was while he was in Central State, and there's a little bit of dialogue that opens as an epigraph between me and the doctor. And so me, I say, I think there's a lot of trauma he has to process. And Dr. K says, did something happen? And this was my response, which came almost immediately after I hung up with her. Medical history number two. The hospital happened. The involuntary happened. The injectables happened. They had to rip his shirt. The doctors, the nurses, the residents, the techs happened. The other patients, some of them pacing in the hall. and loud. The first attempt happened, the one-on-one happened, the EEG happened, the ambulance happened. None of this is in any order, you understand. The restraints and psychosis, the overdoses and non-compliance, the catatonia, the mania happened, the loneliness, the isolation happened. So many, many different meds. The assessments and telehealth happened, more ambulances happened, the courts happened, the ECT happened, the second attempt happened, the social workers happened, the intensive outpatients and treatment teams and therapists happened. 7 years happened. He won't get them back.
This is the poem that on the sell sheet of the book.
Yes.
I think it's very appropriate because it kind of summarizes the trauma around it all, and a trauma that involves everybody around.
It is a little bit of like a prelude. All of the themes and all of the subjects in the book are there. This might have been the point, too, where I realized, I think I have a book, maybe, and I have something to start writing toward and around, and other poems that I have can come into this and be part of it.
Did you ever consider publishing a chapbook with those poems?
No, I had, as you know, two chapbooks that had come out, and I was ready for a full-length collection, and I thought that this might be that, actually. The interesting little center section, there's a center section that is nothing but very short poems about medications.
Yep.
And I actually drafted a lot of those at a Kentucky Poetry Society conference where there was a session on writing a chapbook. And the prompt from, I think it might have been Christopher McCurry, was to just write quickly on a subject and just don't stop. And I said, what do I know a lot about? Oh, I know psych meds, head meds. And so I thought about at one point that could probably stand alone with a little bit of more filling out, but it also serves very well as a section of its own in the book.
Well, why don't you read a few of them and make sure you read Celexa.
Yes. If, you have any acquaintance or familiarity with psych meds, then you know that the names of them, maybe this is true of all sort of trade names for drugs, not the generic names, which tend to be sort of chemical formulations, but the brand name wants to sort of suggest something about what it does. So let me read Celexa. Celexa. Hell no, he wouldn't take it again. He knew it wasn't right, felt it buzzing in his veins like a trapped fly. Wouldn't take a pill that sounded like the name of a goddamn luxury sedan, smooth over winding mountain roads, silent into an inferno of fall colors, flaming in a distant state. I mean, shall I read a few more of these?
Please.
Yeah. They're in alphabetical order, from Abilify to Zyprexa. So this is Depakote. Might as well be called Dedakote, a dumb blunt of a drug dosed by a 500 milligram slug, thuggish old school knockout. Lithium. Created at the universe's brilliant birth, stardust salted over the fires in his brain to bring blessed equilibrium. It silted into his soul like lead, deadening, then aflame anew. Trazodone. Heavy lifting, that trazodone, a mighty bulldozer of a med shoving up the damp sod of sleep. Pill-wise, it dosed high, 50, 100 milligrams. It didn't work.
And these words I read throughout the book, it didn't work, or we were hoping for something to work in a particular way, and it didn't.
It didn't work, or it didn't work the way it should, or it needed another pill with it to work the right way or to control side effects. And, there are like 14 of these. The section's called a bipolar dozen, so of course there are 14. And this is not all of them by a long shot. So the whole medication piece was very frustrating for him, and continues to be frustrating and difficult.
One thing that I love about this book is how you vary form and sizes of the poems throughout the book.
Yeah, this is more, if listeners know my work or any of my work, this is more experimental and certainly a little darker than a lot of my work. And yes, I began working with some non-lineated poems. I wouldn't call them prose poems exactly. They're more, that first poem I read, Medical History Number 2, is in a block. And there's several poems in that form where they're polyvocal, many, many voices, and I'm sort of containing them in a very tight box. On the page, they're justified on both sides, so it looks like a block of text. A square block. And then there's several poems that use staggered lines on the page as well.
I would love to hear Current, the whole thing.
Okay. So this is, again, kind of a flash essay. It's not in lines of poetry, it's in paragraphs. And he had several rounds of ECT, which most people think of as very controversial. It can be a safe and very effective treatment. It's not always what people think, I don't believe. So this is what it's like. I obviously not the experience of it, but what I witness and what he complied with. And it's called Current. March morning, three times a week, the city still dark and empty at 5 a.m. We drive to the hospital on empty streets. The garage park shines like day. We pull in, buzz for a ticket, then park in short-term outpatient, second story. You wear a stocking cap, dark canvas jacket, and sweats most morning. I grip a cup of coffee getting cold and the newspaper still folded. There's no more uncertainty about where to go or what to do. We hurry through automatic doors, hissing their welcome. Gold standard, preferred treatment, painless and safe, not like in the old days. This is your second course of electroconvulsive therapy. We don't know how many sessions it will take or what will happen this time. The first course was at a hospital in St. Paul, Minnesota, where you were taken after a second psychotic break, had panicked the college roommates you were living with while you worked on campus that summer. They called the crisis team after they watched you sit unmoving on the couch for 3 hours. This is what the dean told us. The report would say you had been acting strange for weeks before, that you thought people were changing your streaming station, that people were out to get you, that you started laughing uncontrollably, then suddenly crying during weight training. You landed inpatient for the third time for 2.5 months, during which every diagnosis and failed medication finally led to the gold standard, preferred treatment, painless and safe, not like in the old days. We were believers, educated and desperate. We read the success stories. We understood the sciences and the consequences, minimal, and results, maximal, though not sustained. There is no definite theory as to why ECT is effective for certain psychiatric conditions. It causes a seizure in the brain. It is not understood why a central nervous system seizure is effective treating depression and thought disorders. You agreed. You had already missed preseason training and the start of the semester. There would be no return to school after that fall. After 10 treatments, the doctor pronounced it a success. Fluidity of movement restored, the fog of depression lifted, thought blocking and psychosis muted, you were discharged. You seemed whole, if not happy, when you came home, and we hoped this was a new path. It was not. Check-in, signature and bracelet, time-stamped parking receipt. Sometimes I sit with you in pre-op. A nurse pulls the drape close, and I step outside while you undress. There are warmed blankets and extra pillows. They ask how you're feeling while they connect the IV, take your vitals, confirm that you haven't eaten. I watch the medics busy with purpose. The whir and flash of monitors. Carts stacked with sheets and towels and blankets rattle past. So much white fluorescence, everyone wearing pale blue. The floors shine. Sometimes I read to you from the news. I want to show you how okay this all is. Sometimes I do not stay to see you wheeled away. How brave you were. How irrelevant and frail I felt. We have seen the video, the patient sedated and mild on the bed, There are electrodes and wires, yes. There is a voltage meter and an anesthesiologist and an oxygen mask. There is a mouthpiece, yes. It is not precisely a surgical setting. The attending medical staff wear white coats and stand near, ready to help. There are no domed lights, no masked huddle busy and peering into a draped mound. There is a switch flipped and a buzzing hum as expected, but the only evidence of current is a slight trembling in the toe, a strange straight-armed lifting of the hands like, yes, Frankenstein, roused to life. 30 to 60 seconds. There is no way to predict in an individual treatment the exact number of treatments required. I have never thought of you on that table, though, until now. Once you told me the doc put some Thorazine in the drip to send you soft and sweet into sleep. A kindness. He knew how you hated this bargain. You told me you wanted to stay there forever. I sometimes go to the cafeteria for more coffee, a granola bar, something to do. It's still mostly empty, so I can sit alone anywhere. I watch the time, look at the newspaper, return far too early to the waiting room. I never call anyone. I never text updates. The doctor tells me later he had a good seizure. I think he's responding. Perhaps another week of treatments. You can see him soon. After, we drive home in the early spring light, get something to eat, your choice. Sometimes there was a dream, usually a headache, vague fear when you wake. I remark that it's time to take your usual medications. I know you must be hungry, so I ask you where you'd like to go get some food. A vague shrug. We'll end up in the coffee shop with to-go cups and pastries. I don't ask you how it went. Neither one of us have any idea what has happened.
Wow.
That's the first time I've read that aloud. Some of these poems I've read at our Spalding residency and tried out some things, but I've never read that aloud. So thank you, actually, for letting me read that.
I could barely go through my own read to it because my eyes kept on filling with tears.
I think what was different to me was that what people might think about ECT and what is so hard is in fact not so hard. I mean, it's there's no pain associated. There's no awareness. It's, you know, honestly far less difficult in some ways than other kinds of routine procedures. But the strangeness of it happening, it's not quite medical. You know, I've been in the hospital with a relative before, like taking my dad for surgery. And I'm texting everybody all the time, and everybody wants to know, and how's it going? Is that, how's he doing? Is it going to be good? And it's a very different sort of thing. It was all strange.
It was holding space.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. And it was very early. And he was so, so willing and I think brave to trust us. You know, it didn't really work because crippling depression wasn't really at the heart of what was going on with bipolar disorder in him.
I see so much sadness in many of those poems.
Yeah.
And there is one in which there is overt anger.
I can guess what that might be. Go ahead.
Well, what I don't say to my husband.
That was
I'd love for you to read it.
Okay. There's a bad word.
Two of them even. So yeah. It's fine. It's a podcast.
So I will read this. And for a while, he was going to a bipolar clinic with the University of Louisville Hospital, and I understood the purpose of it, and it was kind of a teaching clinic also for residents, and so it was like every week he would see a different resident, and every resident would kind of come and say, oh, what's going on? And I was just like, do you not have a chart you can read? And it was always terribly behind schedule. We were there hours and hours. So this had been a particularly frustrating, and I just kind of let this go. And I mean, honestly, it was in some ways a release to write, and there's kind of nothing like a rant. And that's really what this is in the tradition of that. So what I don't say to my husband, You can take him next time. You can sit there in the crowded waiting room of the bi-fucking polar clinic. You can wait in the exhaust of his rage and shame. We are broken, torn, cleaving to the last and only primal thread that ties us flesh to flesh. You can wait as your heart rate escalates every quarter hour past the scheduled appointment, fearful he will leave, walk out rattling and mute, leave that loud TV, that loud room, the TV always chattering about home makeovers or low-carb pasta or top of the hour, the din of illness, chorus of psychosis, grinds while each one is startled to attention. The patient that fidgets, distracted. The patient who jumps to attention when every name is called. The patient who greets every person in the room. The patient with no clear social boundaries, who volunteers that CBT has worked great for her, that the day program is great, that they have art therapy and animal therapy, and that she's lost 100 pounds and wants to lose 100 more, and her mother agrees, will confirm that Dr. E is great, a savior. You can take your turn with this week's resident, who emerges with her clipboard. It goes like this. You breathe in and unspool the week's report. Not great. You tell her that we are doing everything, everything we can, and it is killing everything we ever had that was good with our son. And though we will never, never, ever give up hope, that hope is all we have, that springs eternal, that is the thing with feathers, the tunnel, the light, the golden fucking dawn, alive with bird song and buttered scones. And you can tell her the truth, too, because you will never, ever see this one again ever. The truth that we only see bad ends and worse, that this week was terror-tangled sheets and nightmares strobing at the edge of consciousness, that we are preparing to lose our son. And you can let me know later when you are home exactly what she said, if she wrote anything down at all. All right, wow. So I'm a little pissed off now too. Again.
Oh, It is so much energy.
Yeah, it's a frustrating process, and I understand the protocols because there have been so many encounters with clinicians of just kind of wanting to get to know what's going on, but it's difficult.
It's difficult to talk to the staff, but also it's difficult to talk to the well-meaning.
Yeah,
the well-meaning people who offer advice.
And, right.
And then there is a poem about it. I would love. I mean, you say it all in there. So,
yeah.
If you would read it, that would be wonderful.
That is Everyone Has Been So.
Yep.
Yeah. And I do want to say that regarding well-meaning people, you know, our friends and family have been astoundingly supportive and incredibly enlightened in their understanding of what mental illness is. I know that there is a lot of talk about the need to erase stigma, but and I don't disagree, but we have been lucky that the people around us see our son for who he's always been and do not think we did something wrong or that this was caused by something he did or that I think some people confuse mental illness with some kind of congenital disability and are always shocked to hear, you know, he graduated from college, he's really smart. But there are lots of suggestions. And this is one of these poems that's also blocked. And it represents lots of voices. Everyone has been so. There's a guy at our church. Could you get him involved? Service would be an option, or volunteer. Maybe a dog. He needs to be outside. Do you think he would like, what about volunteer? Have you talked to anyone at Habitat? I have a friend whose son, maybe he could find, they usually need people. There's Habitat too. Our daughter's friend has a group. He needs to find meaningful. What about fixing up the basement into, our nephew had a great experience with, one of our neighbors works for Habitat. Maybe I could connect you with, I've heard that winter can be bad for. Have you called? This was a long time ago, but my stepbrother had a lot of luck with. This guy at work mentioned Habitat. I saw an article about support animals. Maybe a lawyer or someone who. Structure is so. Have you tried the website for Habitat? My son's roommate did work one summer for it. Have you tried? There's Habitat. Maybe you could contact Habitat. Is there anyone? Habitat. Yes, we appreciate you all.
Explain Habitat.
So I, for whatever reason, there was a period there where I was getting a lot of suggestions about volunteering for Habitat for Humanity. Outdoors. It's a great organization, and I certainly do not mean this in any way as dismissive of that organization, both for the service it provides to communities and individuals, but also for the, you know, meaningful voluntary experiences it provides for everyone from young to old people. But for whatever reason, I just kept hearing that one a lot. And it coincided with the notion of, and he needs somewhere to live,
right.
You know. That was like, where is he going to be? Where is he going to live? So.
When did you know that your book is ready?
Like I said, it took a long time to put this in order. And as I was saying, too, Red Hen took a draft of it early. So I kind of had that to relax into, which was nice. I knew that I had several years, honestly, because of the way they line folks up kind of in a queue. And that's neither here nor there in terms of whether that's better or worse than what other presses might do. But I knew I had plenty of poems. It was just, which ones was it going to be? And what do I need to write toward? And I got some early response from the managing editor there about some things in that regard. And I had a deadline coming up. And so I really, my strategy with a collection is to lay it all out in my attic study and look at it and move it around and see about sections and where the sections were and whichever. There's four sections, which also feels uncomfortable to me, which is good because this book is chaotic and uncomfortable. Other books have three. Three is nice, or Covet is just one section. But this was four, and that felt a little bit unsettling, and I was okay with that. There are two very distinct sections that are kind of a piece, a first long poem. But then the other two sections of individual poems, it just took a really long time to figure out what this was and how they go together. And I finally kind of settled on the first section being more drawing on and pointing to imagery of fire, electricity, activity, mania. And it's actually the fourth section, pulling more images of rain and dark, not scary, bad dark, but rain and storm and quieter maybe a little bit, and depression, really. And so the poems fall out sort of generally. I don't know that it's perfect, but that finally felt like the right way to weight those around the two other sections, the psych med section, the bipolar dozen, and then the long poem that opens it. So when I got it there, I realized, oh, okay, now this is good. Now this is set. So now we're just into line tinkering and changing titles and that kind of thing.
I think the whole book is brilliant.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I'm nervous about it. I shared it with my son when I got the advance review copies, and he said some of it was hard, some of it was accurate. That poem I read about the bipolar clinic, I think actually thought some parts of it were good and also a little bit funny because he recognized so much of it. He said, yeah, there's always that person who doesn't have any boundaries, and there's always that person who is greeting everybody. Some of the clinical stuff I think was hard. But he's aware of the book. He's 29. He's aware of the book, and I think he's, I don't quite know what a public campaign's going to be. We've obviously shared with friends. This is nothing we've tried to hide, but at the same time, protecting his privacy is important. So I'm not really sure how all this is going to unfold going forth in very public ways. But here I am on a podcast. So,
did it feel risky for you to publish this?
No, actually. I know that seems strange. I felt like this is what I have. This is what I have now. I'd like to think maybe I'll be able to start some conversations among family and supporters. I don't know that this is a book that will be always... it could make some clinicians uncomfortable. I mean, I'm in some places...
Their turn, right?
Huh?
It's their turn.
Yeah, you know, I'm fairly critical of the bipolar clinic, and I'm fairly critical of clinicians in other settings, and there's anger here. But the more I talk to people about it, the more I recognize, the more that people sort of open up that they have an adult child with a serious mental illness, and they just simply cannot find answers or adequate support, and that the programs don't work the way they're intended, or for individuals like my son, I hope that starts some conversations there.
Talk about the epigraph to the book.
Well, I'll read it. This is from Catcher in the Rye, and this is Holden Caulfield. I'm not going to tell you my whole goddamn autobiography or anything. I'll just tell you about this madman stuff that happened to me. And several years ago, I was into writing some of these poems, but just only a little bit. And I sat on a project of kind of rereading some of the books that my kids had read in high school. And just because partially I was interested more in young adult literature and trying to understand what that was. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to go reread a couple of these books that were sort of cornerstones of. And I had read myself Catcher in the Rye in like eighth grade or something and thought it was, ugh, couldn't stand Holden Caulfield, thought he was like pretentious and why couldn't he get together and blah, 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 blah. And that was that. And the kids both read Catcher in the Rye in high school as well. So I picked up their copy. In fact, I picked up my younger son's copy, which had all of his annotations in it, which was also interesting when he had read it at 14. And I started reading, and I recognized something that I had not recognized when I went in eighth grade, because I had no conceptual framework for recognizing it in eighth grade. And that is that book opens, and Holden Caulfield is in a residential psych facility. And I realized he's telling this to doctors. And I really started crying because I didn't realize this. Oh, my God. This is his story. And this is where he landed in a residential psych. And at that point, our son had been in a residential psych. I knew exactly where Holden Caulfield was. I knew exactly why he was there. And then I proceeded to read the book through a lens of mental illness. And I know that's a really dangerous thing to do with a piece of literature. I'm not all about, you know, Freudian analysis of Hamlet. Not my thing. But I started reading that through a sense that I think this is not the weekend I thought it is. I think this whole weekend, and the book takes place over, he tells a story of about a 72-hour period where he's kicked out of prep school and then proceeds to completely cycle down, or cycle up. It's clear he's on a manic tear, and he's awake for 72 hours, and then he crashes in the park in the rain. And so I realized, this is what this is. And so there's a sense in which that spirit haunts this a little bit as a very troubled young man just trying to get a grip on things and not succeeding. It's really unclear at the end of Catcher in the Rye what's going to happen to him. So that's, I use that as an epigraph, and then I have one poem about him. I mentioned earlier, among other poems, about characters in, and also real people too, like Robert Lowell, Zelda Fitzgerald. You know, I read some incredible biographies in doing some kinds of research for this, talking about their struggle, particularly Robert Lowell with bipolar disorder.
And some other figures.
Yes.
How about if you read God Inside the Head of Moses?
Oh, boy, that was a poem I revised and revised 30, and revised.
Page 30.
I just could not get that one right. But I just felt like I think there's something here.
Oh, it's brilliant.
And in this poem and also in the poem about Cordelia, I pull in sort of some contemporary references. I have Moses in an internship and to kind of muddle the sense of what's happening. So this is God Inside the Head of Moses, and it has the epigraph from Exodus chapter 4, verse 13. But he said, "Oh my Lord, please send someone else." God Inside the Head of Moses says, "Get up, get out, you pampered bastard prince. You weren't born to be the king. Your swampy birth pulled fishy from the reeds, your mother's servant class or worse. You know this. You know this like you know you're at the center of something. Climate change and politics, celebrity deaths, revolution. Nights you pace and write, write and pace, try to sort it out. One, you're being groomed for something. The internships, study abroad, fake commitments. command of empire, labor, stone upon stone upon stone to heaven. Two, the scepter keeps turning to a serpent. Repeat, the scepter keeps turning to a serpent. Three, you can't contain the curse, slaughter, storm, contagion, exodus, revolt, judgment. You're at the center of something. The dream each night keeps pounding, the roar of hooves, the wall of water, the boxwoods all on fire. So that imagines him as a younger man there, perhaps already being called, whatever you want to make of that, and how terrifying that must have been. Yeah, and from a very clinical modern perspective, which I don't think is the appropriate way to read the Bible, but, well, it could be that he's crazy.
You have the right to read anything in your own way through whatever lens you wish.
Right. But again, I am sort of personally leery of sort of armchair diagnosing literary characters or sacred texts, but it's sort of interesting to think through that and to imagine that. So that's what's happening there. But I think probably whatever you believe about Moses, I think hearing a call ostensibly from God would be terrifying, absolutely terrifying.
What I want to hear is the villanelle.
Ah, okay. This is one where I'm going to get in trouble with the therapy community, the psychologists. Yeah, results of the assessment one. There's two. There are a lot of tests. He's filled in a lot of bubble sheets with psychological assessments and lots of batteries and, you know, assessments and so forth. And this is results of the assessments one. And you mentioned it's a villanelle, which is a form that I have used before when I have a first person plural speaker, we. It's a very repetitive form, and I think that the first person plural perspective often has a little bit of menace in it, and I think it works really well. Results of the assessment one. What we observe is what we want to see. Axis elevated on multiphasic inventory 2 for depression, anxiety, and also here C, severe, single episode, non-bizarre we see. Cognitive normal across the board 2, but ruminative without insight, unable to see how the thematic apperception suggests he sees dark horizons, dark valleys he is unable to climb. And the evil surrounding he thinks he sees, combined with paranoia, though slight we see, align with the Beck depression version 2. And the sleeplessness congruent, don't you see? The delusions and mania, belief people see his black soul, the pacing and psychosis, too, confirm the metrics and the history that we see. Yes, that's it exactly, sort of, here, you see? Your son, your boy, your man someday, too. But you have another one, don't you, too? We've charted him here, signed, for you to see.
So what have you planned for promotions?
It's all kind of coming together now. I'm going to be doing some readings around here. The book comes out in late April, which puts me sort of out of the high season. You know, reading series tend to kind of go from September to May, and college campuses are, again, also kind of September to end of April. So I'll be doing some things around here. I'll be reading at the table in December. And I'm going to read with the Spalding 21C series in June, reading at Carmichael's Books in May 16th. So a few things regionally through the summer, and then hopefully in the fall, maybe get on the road a little bit. I have lived a long time and still have a lot of family in the Pacific Northwest, so I want to get out there as well.
And I have one last question mm-hmm. for you, and that is a question that I ask all my guests who teach creative writing. I have asked you that question before.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, the question is, what is the most important thing you teach your students if you want them to remember one thing from your class or workshop? What is it?
So one thing I hope students take from my workshop would be read the drafts of your poems aloud. You can tell so much about the pacing and the line, particularly as it end stopped or running on, about how the sounds are working together or not, and even expository things like, this doesn't make sense, this grammar is weird, I've got the wrong verb here. And so read the drafts of your poems aloud.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you so much.